It's always fun to listen to Cindy talk about Rat, which is something, an institution, as it were, that's really close to my heart. I was working on the project that became my book, The Fiction of a Thinkable World. Cover looks like that. There are some copies at the AK Press stand that I dropped there, and I'd be happy to sign them to anybody who wants to pay for one. Worked on it for a very long time, and I really didn't think of any kind of specific political context for it until I came here almost on a whim last year. And it was what I call the sort of Monsieur Jourdain moment, Monsieur Jourdain being the Molière character who was pleased to discover that without knowing it all of his life he had been speaking prose. And something the same way, I decided that all those years when I had been working on this book, I had been theorizing anarchism without knowing it. But when I look back just the other day at the title I'd given this presentation, I can't actually remember when I did that. I thought if I were not me and I were looking at it, I would say, why the hell neurology? And why not something that sounds more directly political, like economics or human rights or any of the other categories in which we put the awful problems that are facing us these days? And the reason I went into neurology and cognitive science to a certain extent, and a lot more philosophy than I ever wanted to read, was because I kept finding the normal notion of agency that was implicit in the historical work and the political theorizing that I was reading to be pretty inadequate. Everybody made the assumption that people were good rational agents who sometimes were not rational, but who were pursuing individual goals. And if they were not pursuing individual goals, they had somehow been socialized into a state in which they saw common goals as something better. That always sounded a little dismal because, you know, they were giving up on their individual goals. And I began to suspect that this didn't explain why people did what they did. It certainly didn't explain why people did what they did in the past, and it didn't make a whole lot of sense in relatively recent history, in which, as we know, people very consciously and coherently do awful things in the name of what appear to be irreproachable ideals. And I began to think that what really was most important was not talking about the kinds of values or ends to which acts are directed in different communities, as the nature of the world that each community had. And back, in the late 1970s, when I first tried to put this stuff into a book, back then it was called Producing Experience. Oh no, it was called Ideology and Consciousness. Rather structuralist text. I thought that we make worlds through language. It seemed a very, very ordinary assumption. Those of you who read the old literature, I would cite Saper and Whorf and usual stuff. And I came to a lot of dead ends. Every time I tried to sort of explain to people why it was that we didn't actually see what we were doing, they looked at me like I was out of my mind. I began to think I was out of my mind. I let the thing drop for about 10 years. About 8 or 9 years ago, for reasons I can't remember now, I came across the work of Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who were a couple of theoretical biologists who did their most important work in the 1970s. They were both associated in one way or another with the Allende government, and Varela left Chile when Pinochet took over and spent the rest of his life in France. Maturana and Varela developed a notion of the way organisms work that they refer to as an autopoietic theory. That's A-U-T-O-P-O-I-E-T. TIC. Basically, organisms are beings that create and maintain themselves. The interesting thing about this is that it starts from what appears to be a completely solipsistic point of view. You know, an organism, there's nothing that comes in, nothing that goes out of an organism. Yet at the same time, everything that is the organism, everything that the organism does, is something which arises because of its structural coupling with everything else. So you have the sort of large complex of interacting, yet somehow self-subsisting objects or organisms. I'm not a follower of Maturana Varela, although there is some very interesting work they've done. And it's really worth looking up. There's a lot of material that's on the web worth spending time with. But it was with Maturana Varela that I began to understand that I might get someplace if I stopped thinking about what we did as something that happened in our heads linguistically, but really more something that we live, that every act that a living being does is essentially something cognitive. Simply the fact that those organisms cannot tell us what they know does not mean that they don't incarnate some level of knowledge. You know, a jellyfish can be said to know how to orient itself in the ocean and how to maintain itself at the appropriate depth where there is the right amount of light so the right amount of plankton that it eats can be found. Obviously, the jellyfish doesn't think about that, but there is a level of knowledge that the jellyfish, in a sense, lives through. And in fact, there's absolutely no reason why most of what we do isn't to, you know, basically like what a jellyfish does, or it's probably more flattering when I think about the way our cats act. They're wonderful subjects because they are very deeply involved with things that happen around the house. They don't appear to have anything like consciousness. If they did, I think there would be a kind of smear from one action to the next, the way we smear one action into another. We're still thinking of one thing while we do another. Cats aren't like that, they change. But they are very tightly bound into the specificity of their environment, and they react in ways that we think we're reacting to through complex intellectual processes. And they're not. In fact, a lot of contemporary neurological studies come up with all sorts of ridiculous paradoxes. There is a fairly well-known experiment where people are asked to watch a clock, make a decision to raise an arm, and record for the experimenter the time at which they have made the decision. And it turns out that in every case, people are moving their arm before they have any idea that they've decided to move their arm. The book goes into a good many of these, probably not always as many as I should if I really wanted to convince people. But I think that it's not at all difficult to see that this is the way it happens. When people act in moments of extreme stress, people who pull other people from burning airplanes, for example, say afterwards, you know, I really don't know why I decided to do that, I just did it. Some of them will say, well, God was acting through me and I did it. And I think that's, you know, a useful hint as to what it is that people usually refer to when they talk about God. We can even learn things without knowing it. I assume that most of you got a chance to see the film Memento. And if not, you may well be familiar with people who have lost the ability to form any kind of memories anymore. It turns out that you can train people who have no memory to do different things. You can, for instance, walk someone who does not remember you from one training session to the next and does not remember that they've had a training session. You walk them through the tasks needed to work in an office. At some point, they do know how to do what they need to do in an office. They have no memory whatsoever of having learned it. Phenomena such as blind sight, where people who have certain kinds of blindness can turn keys the correct way, can see which way a key needs to be inserted into a lock. They can't see the key. They simply know because the particular pathways that connect the eyes to those parts of the brain that are conscious of vision are gone. But those pathways that connect the eyes to things that turn, you know, that control the orientation of the hand for action, those are still there. One last case I'd like to point out is something that does not seem to have been noticed much in North America, but I've found quite a few references in Europe. About 10 years ago, a group of neurologists in the University of Parma, Giovanni Rizzolatti and Vittorio Gallese, announced that they had discovered these things called mirror neurons. Every single one of you that was paying attention when I picked up the pen had something happen in your brain. The same neurons that fired in my brain for me to pick up the pen fired in yours as well. There's a very large repertory of gestures and sounds, generally extremely specific in content. For instance, if I had manipulated one of those toy hands that you get in souvenir shops to pick up the pen, nothing would have happened in your brains. So they only respond to human beings or perhaps other primates picking up the pen. We reflect each other constantly. And that is actually one of the fundamental discoveries of contemporary neurology that I think plays very much into politics, and I'll get into why it plays into politics eventually. I ended up with a kind of sort of working hypothesis that what constitutes human activity and human agency is not the activity of a centered consciousness confronted with an environment from which choices are made and upon which action is you know, feeds back. But there are a huge number of mutually interacting, entangled, multiply centered feedback loops in which all kinds of actions and reactions essentially reflect back on one another. In those, the most important of it, they sort of cluster around affect-laden processes. One of the lines I came across in doing the historical research for the book is a wonderful line in Cicero. He says, "Animals don't have emotions, but they have behavior like emotions." And he was writing from a Stoic point of view, and then for the Stoics, emotions were in fact logical judgments. So, you know, in that context, it's certainly true. But I think it is true as well, in that animals have the corporeal sensations that to us, when we think about them, register as emotions. But they exist whether you think about them or not. I mean, I have a cat who has an addictive personality. We have to hide toys from her because she gets obsessed with them. And and I've read all kinds of things about, you know, child rearing and bad parenting and so on causing this. And here's this cat doing the same thing. The fact that these are presented to us in emotion is something very important because, in fact, one of the other points that I drew from people like Antonio Damasio and other neurologists is that any kind of human decision is totally impossible without affect. There are cases of people who have had their prefrontal lobes destroyed. The most famous was a man in the 19th century named Phineas Gage. Dynamite explosion put a rod through his head. And other than the fact that he had a hole in his head and had no emotional state whatsoever from then on, he was perfectly normal. He also ruined everything he touched because he could never make a reasonable decision. Now, we find people like that doing things like listening to what your mother might have said to you at one point when you said, you know, I don't know if I should go to this camp or that camp. And she might have said, well, draw a line down the middle of a piece of paper and put the pros on one side and the cons on the other. And then you'll know what you want to do. I doubt my mother ever did that, because when I tried it, it didn't do any good. But for those people, they can drop the pros and cons forever and ever, but they never actually make up a decision. There is no way for them to decide. You know, and I think it's a token of our obsession with the conscious rational mind that Gene Roddenberry comes up with a character like Mr. Spock. You know, honestly, if there were a Mr. Spock and he had gone to Starfleet Academy, somehow he would have washed out in the first week. You know, because he couldn't make his mind up about anything. There are two really important conclusions to me that follow from the work I had done reading this. And one is that you really are driven to conclude these processes are so intertwined, the structural coupling is so complete, that the subpersonal world is one in which there is no boundary between self or other. As Susan Hurley, who is a sort of rebarbative but worthwhile contemporary philosopher of mind, points out, there's nothing particularly oomphy about the skin. You know, we are all transparent to causality. A psychologist I know actually said, you know, what I was talking to her about this, and she said, you know, it sounds to me like a dance, and everybody has their arms and legs tied together. And it's not that they're all doing one thing that is driven by the arms and legs, but what they all do is something that is an odd kind of summation and expression of all the individual gestures added together. And the individual gestures in themselves don't mean anything unless you understand the context out of which they've come. And the other is the point I think I may have adverted to at the beginning, which is that it's really only in consciousness, those odd shreds of feedback loops that have developed in us and probably in no one else, that sort of communicate throughout our mental life or sort of have a kind of odd kind of conscious existence, which does not seem to be very easy to talk about, but which enables us to kind of smear one reaction over another. I mean, Darwin's argument for the origin of consciousness was drawn from watching birds fly south during the end of summers where their young had hatched late. And the young would starve to death. But the drive to go south with the change in the seasons was far too strong for the bird to do anything else. And Darwin said perhaps one of the things that consciousness does in species that need to spend a lot of time with raising children is it allows certain emotions that would otherwise be overwhelmed by others to be maintained long enough that the others can be restrained. It's not actually a moral argument, but it's very hard for us to speak of it in a way that doesn't sound moral. But those feedback loops that are conscious are only a fragment of our mental life, if you want to call all of it our mental, or your cognitive life. But it's only in those in which the possibility arises for us to think of ourselves as somehow separate and self-constituting, as confronting the world, as drawing information from it, whereas in fact what we do is simply incarnate the state of the world, which we can then in a sense read consciously. And it's open this way for different communities to imagine themselves differently, and the way in which people interact, the way in which people respond one to another, the way in which people traditionally act towards other animals, towards trees. These are all things which shape what it is that appears consciously as the nature of our experience. It's not that one can simply make up a reality, however. I mean, there is actually a reality, and it always bites back. If you have some sort of imagined world, or a world which did appropriately imagine a world which has disappeared, it too is eventually going to fade. There is always a kind of gravitational pull of the actual forms of human interaction that organizes the structures of emotional life and on top of that, the structures of mental life that present themselves to people as the world. It doesn't simply mirror it, because there's always a kind of loose fit, but there is a limited range within which one can think about the particular kind of life that one is in fact living. You can draw lots of critique within any given system of life, but the alternatives you pose are dangerous because they are generally alternatives within that specific world, and they can't transcend it or offer a different world to it. This is where I begin to move back into history and politics, because way back, my original inspiration of the whole project was the idea that there was one really strange thing about the world that we live in the West under capitalism, and that's the world that we throw up socially, the world that we unconsciously constitute through our daily life, is one in which the fact that that is what we are doing is concealed. The prime... The great gravitational center, the black hole at the heart of capitalist thought that brings us all together, is the denial that that is the process that we're engaged in. The face that capitalism presents itself to itself, which is the face that we present to ourselves, is that, somebody dropped us off here. I, a stranger and afraid in a world I never made. And even if we like it, it is still a world that was there, and we are apart from it. And all the rhetoric of capitalism comes from that, and it seems to me that is really all you need to grant, and you re-elaborate capitalism in one form or another. Once you understand human existence as a form of self-composition, and once you think of human action in the world as a form of choice, at that point you've already laid the foundation of a world which justifies itself by giving choice the predominant structuring feature. I think if I'm going to finish this in 10 minutes, I will skip a bit through sort of the historical part, which I find actually, as somebody who is trained as an historian, which I was, the most fun part to read. And I'll try to read a little bit from the book, which I have printed out here. The dialectic of self and social is enough in the foreground of our lives to become a staple of the popular arts. You know, you think about Western films or the Cog and the Machine films, like King Vidor's The Crowd. These films are so popular because they reflect our own dilemma. On the one hand, we are granted the most awe-inspiring powers. As autonomous rational beings, we must think for ourselves. In the context of our history, that means we must construct a usable model of experience from the standpoint of an authoritative or authentic self. We are expected to choose goals and to craft our lives so we can achieve them. In other words, to project a self in which to live out our days against the constraints of the world as we perceive them. But these vast powers of self-creation and autonomy crumble at a touch, like ash, because real activity and agency reside in the incomparably more powerful realm of the social. Man proposes, God disposes, it used to be said, but these days it's the social world that allows or bars the fulfillment of any hopes we dreams we hope to realize. This goes far beyond the inevitable conflicts between our desires and those of others. All the wishes and needs of the rest of the world's people come to us summarized and unified in the apparently objective demands of the social. Its word is law, and from its decree, no appeal is possible. It is impassive as fate. Each one of us faces this faceless and heartless tyrant as an isolated being. Paradoxically, the one common experience in the modern Western world is that of being the last person left standing. But you know, why is it so appealing? You know, and why, one of the things that I think is that lies behind its tremendous universal success is that it does seem, you know, liberal capitalism does seem to propose nothing in the sort of Rorkian sense. And it's therefore something which substitutes very nicely for the sort of disintegrated state of any pre-industrial society that has already been penetrated by the market to the point where traditional relations of production and traditional human interactions have disappeared. Capitalism does not reestablish community on other, possibly contentious bases, but simply stabilizes whatever process of dissolution is already underway. It is enough that whatever ties there were between people have weakened to the point of breaking. This social space then becomes the necessary and sufficient foundation for the separation imposed by the capitalist order. It basically says to us, you know, you can do whatever you want. It's wonderful. You can have any life you want. We just ask one thing. And the one thing is a separation between the personal and the social. And that's the Faustian price. You end up solely as a self-sufficient entity facing a separated power in the form of a market, a job market, a market of commodities, a political marketplace. The actual social process that generates and sustains people in factories, apartment blocks, subway systems, political parties, and television news channels alike is concealed behind a purported rationality of institutions on the one hand, and an even more specious faculty of choice on the part of the individual, who offers herself freely as a job applicant and who makes free decisions among alternatives as a consumer or voter. Prior forms of human life have been sustained by overt argument, by the authority of myth or religious suasion, by maxims and by force. And myth can be doubted, religious doctrines disputed or disproved, maxims mocked, and the brave can challenge the army. But capitalism is different. Its ideology takes the form of experience itself. And where one gets to at this point then is whatever you want to criticize of the institutions of capitalism appears to be incoherent. Because they say, come now, we are open. We have no position to take. We do what you choose. And because of that, you are actually asking to restrain freedom by criticizing them. I mean, the classic Donish argument is Isaiah Berlin's about negative and positive freedom. Positive freedom is actually just another name for tyranny. You know, and indeed, if you start from the idea that the critique of capitalism has to proceed from why it is that I feel my desires are not met, and you never leave the point of saying that the purpose of a society is to allow people to have the needs that they somehow outside of it have produced, you don't do anything except produce a sort of bastardized form of capitalism or state socialism, which was, after all, a thoroughly bourgeois kind of dream imposed on a society. You know, the best thing that you can say about liberal democracy is that it's at least consistent so that it doesn't have to repress quite so much as a system that is trying to maintain some kind of inconsistency. That isn't to say it doesn't repress at an extremely high level. But what has always bothered me about capitalism is not so much the level of repression. You know, I'm just sort of strange enough that I'll say I'll leave other people to complain about that, because what I can complain about is it's deprived us of our ability to live as human beings and to say the most important of all human words, which is we. The kind of discourse that capitalism embraces is the kind of discourse that can't point outside of itself. The kind of totalizing discourse in which any glimpse of genuine life lies outside of language and thus seems nonsensical or chaotic. You know, we destroyed the kind of mystified version of human self-constitution together that we had in religion. And we don't have it anyplace else. So the only thing left to do in language is to maintain the fiction that nothing else really matters. You know, it is universal, and at the same time, it's completely empty. The kind of pluralism that it then embraces doesn't stigmatize any kind of social expression, but it doesn't allow anything to mean anything either. It tolerates and can make use of every kind of political and social conflict, transgressive art, sexual and transsexual variety, and every manner of species diversity. Because, basically, for one thing, they can be marketed to and marketed in themselves, but also because they contribute to the kind of thick discourse, the webs of speech about each other and our problems, that is where we're confined. The whole point of political and social debates under capitalism is never to end. It's just to provide the surface of a tremendous and vigorous debate. You know, we think that we have finally landed on the ground. In fact, what we're doing is walking over this dense mat of words. There's a wonderful line in one of Kenneth Fearing's poems. Kenneth Fearing was although he really was, the proletarian poet of the 30s. And there's one of his American Rhapsodies has a line about a taut silver skin will be stretched over the dark bottom of the world. And this is sort of the society of the spectacle before it, but beforehand. But that is it. I mean, the entire purpose of capitalism in discourse is to conceal the fact that the discourse is pointless. creativity and spontaneity flourish only in the space between discourse and experience, only between what can be said and what cannot be said. But that has been collapsed with our self-identification with the thinking subject and the social order which that comes from, that supports it, and which is justified by it. We cover over the wound we have made with useless words. Among them are the slogans that only in this way is human freedom genuinely protected, and that capitalism is therefore the sole guardian of universal human values. But it's one kind of universality only. It is the universal imposition of human isolation and the obliteration of human individuality. But what does that mean politically? It means, I think, that the only coherent political position is the one that I think I've always seen in the anarchist tradition, which says that theory is well and good, but it is useful only as something to be left behind. Just as the Buddha said that, my words are like the raft you build to get across a river, and you don't put the raft on your back and keep walking after you've crossed it. It is a difficult thing to try to create something unimaginable, but on the other hand, as Simone Weil once said of God, the only thing really necessary is to say no to everything that isn't that. And I think now that I've been reading, since the completion of the book, reading a lot of the German idealists of the beginning of the 19th century, and thinking about the early Marx, especially in the context of people like Fichte and Schelling, rather than just against Hegel, Fichte especially was talking about how it is that the world is real to us. Where does the givenness about it come from? Why does it seem natural that everything is what it is? We just take it for granted. And when I read Marx talking about the active side of human understanding being developed only by idealism, but abstractly, I think what he's talking about is Fichte. Heine, who was one of Marx's friends, uses just those two adjectives to describe Fichte. And I think in the kind of understanding of what human alienation is and what human freedom really is, that's in the early Marx before his split with Proudhon, before he really addressed questions of political parties and political theories, I think there's a very solid foundation for understanding this as something which has been at least a subterranean part of some of the more subterranean currents of the left for a good 150 years. And I hope that as we begin to see how it is that we can, in a way, act without imposing ourselves on the future, that we can actually take steps towards that creation of the unimaginable, because I don't know any other way to go forward. That was supposed to be 40 minutes, so that's what that was. And I am very happy to try to answer questions or take brickbats or anything else.